on air, online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Farm safety advocates urging farmers to report all incidents, including near misses on the farm.
During COVID, a bit of an uptick of farm incidences, and that was really down to the fact that we didn't have any workers. People who were living on the land and farmers were doing a lot more work to get the crop off, and they were doing that by themselves without any real workforce capacity.
And demand for natural insecticides is up, which means manufacturers are prepared to pay more to pyrethrum growers.
Including this year for planting and last year, the payment increase has been nearly 30%. So we're hoping that'll really attract growers back into considering pyrethrum an attractive opportunity.
We'll also visit the Royal East Sydney Easter Show today, and one farmer has six lambs from one ewe. That's one busy mother. Stay with us right till the end of our program when we'll have Richard Bailey, our livestock reporter. And if you'd like to join the conversation, text in on 0438 922 936. But first, we're going to go to the honey and bee industry. And joining me on the line is the president of the Southern Tasmanian Beekeepers Association, Ross Gordon. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Fiona. How are you?
Thanks so much for joining the Country Hour. Now, we're at the end of the season, aren't we, for beekeepers right round Tasmania? Is that correct?
Yes.
And so what are they all doing now? What do you do at this time of year?
Well, most of them will have reduced their hive sizes, the number of boxes on their hives, down to whatever they carry through winter. Normally for the southern part of Tasmania, it would be four boxes high, four, if I say boxes, I think most people will know what I mean.
I think they do, high. Yes.
Yep. Meaning that they've got sort of 20 kgs of honey, 20 plus kgs of honey to get them through winter.
So they leave quite a bit of honey there for the bees to eat over winter to keep them alive?
Well, yes, it's good practice. You should. It doesn't always work out, depending if something doesn't flower when it should or the weather impacts it or something like that. So that's the first thing they do. And then they'll be starting to bring their bees out of the rainforests back to their winter grounds.
So some people may have seen some trucks laden with beehives coming out of some of those sort of southwest or west coast areas.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah. And how's the season been for beekeepers?
It's been very mixed. On the whole, it's been pretty poor. The January cold snap, which just seemed to go on and on, seemed to impact it quite heavily. And then, you know, most people think it was a really dry season, but actually the rainforests were really wet. So I don't know what impact that had, but the combination of cold and wet wasn't great.
Okay, that's interesting. So that was going to be my next question. Has the dry affected production at all? But it sounds like some of those areas where you might get manuka and honeys like that, not so much.
No. It's been the rainforests. I mean, I know they're called rainforests for a reason, but you know, there's a point at which the rain becomes too much. Some of our honey comes from the drier part of the state. The prickly box is a good example, and that was very poor for the opposite reason. It was bone dry, and I've never seen such a strong divide, strong rain shadow effect as this year.
Yeah, so the extreme dry and then extreme wet in the rainforest.
I don't know if it was extreme wet, but it was definitely persistent light rain quite a lot of the days through summer, yeah.
So do you think there'll be less production out of Tassie this season?
Yes.
And that's what you're hearing anecdotally?
Well, definitely in the south. There's some parts of the north have had a really good season because the west coast has had a string of really bad seasons. So they had a better season this year because they got rain. But it still wasn't great. But there are always little patches of success in any bad season, and little patches of failure in any good season. So you know, it's never it's never cut and dried.
Okay. And so now people are just closing up those hives. Is it still about processing as well at the moment? Is a lot of work in the factory?
Very little. I think most people will have taken the last of their honey off. The last trip I did to the West Coast, I noticed that some of them still had honey to take off, but I reckon 90-something percent of beekeepers have done that now, and their bees are just waiting to come out. You know, they sort of come to the point where they actually look forward to it, I think. It gets so cold and wet.
Yes, they look forward. So they're all put on sort of warmer grounds, so you have winter areas for them.
Yes.
Yes, all right,
warmer
Ross,
and drier, yeah.
Fantastic. Ross Gordon, President of the Southern Tasmanian Beekeepers Association, thanks for joining the Country Hour.
Thank you, Fiona. Cheers.
This week on Landline, we're taking you on a long weekend getaway without leaving home. First stop, the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Sharks for miles. Like, there's so many sharks and dolphins and fish, and it's alive up there.
And we go four-wheel driving in Western Australia.
They use their right foot too much, use too much accelerator and soft sand, and they're just digging themselves in.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, the Federal Department of Agriculture continues to investigate the deaths of more than 100 Australian cattle on board the export ship Brahman Express that sailed to Indonesia earlier this month. It won't confirm how many cattle have died. Industry groups say the cattle came from the one property in the Northern Territory, and it is assumed the toxin botulism caused the cattle deaths. Australia's chief vet, Beth Cookson, explains how botulism presents in livestock.
The cattle that died on board the vessel were not showing any signs that would make us suspect a disease like foot and mouth disease or lumpy skin disease. As a part of the investigation into the cause of the mortalities on the vessel, the department has been working closely with the exporter and the Northern Territory government to understand why that disease, why the mortality event has occurred. That has included sending veterinary officers to the registered establishment that prepared the cattle, and it has been identified that a number of cattle has also died within that facility. So we know that the signs that are being expressed are consistent with botulism.
Yeah, the industry suggested that botulism could be the cause or was the number one suspect, I suppose. How prevalent or how common is it that you would have mortality rates on a live export ship caused by botulism?
Well, botulism is a common bacteria globally, including in Australia. It's only under very specific environmental conditions that the bacteria starts to generate a toxin that essentially when eaten or is contaminating water creates this condition in cattle. And so what we suspect has occurred is that the exposure occurred prior to export and that the cattle, when they were inspected for export were not showing any clinical signs of disease, but that disease developed once they were on the livestock voyage.
What's the incubation period?
The incubation period can be up to 17 days after exposure. Often it's more quick than that. But what we do find is once the incubation period has completed and the animals have been infected by the toxin, that the rapid onset occurs and the animals then die quite quickly after that.
So it is fatal in cattle?
Usually it's fatal. We would say that more often than not, animals that have been infected will die of the toxin. There is no specific treatment for botulism once the animals have been exposed to the toxin. Some animals may recover through supportive therapy by making sure that they've got food and water and shade, but that's not the usual. That's not the usual outcome.
But there is a vaccine that could potentially prevent botulism in cattle, is that right?
Yes, there is a vaccine that can be used in cattle and is commonly used in Australian cattle. That's why we don't regularly see mortalities at this scale.
And just to be clear, because I understand humans can contract a form of botulism too, but what we're talking about here in the livestock is quite a separate disease, and that if humans are handling infected livestock, it's highly unlikely that they will in fact be infected or sick. Is that right?
There are a number of different types of botulinum toxins, and people are not usually susceptible to the ones that affect cattle. What I would be saying is that meat from clinically normal animals in herds affected by a botulism outbreak is safe for human consumption.
And when will we know, when is it likely that the department will be able to confirm this suspected botulism or otherwise?
The investigation is ongoing. Botulism is usually diagnosed by veterinarians through the way that the disease is expressed, the clinical signs on the ground, as well as excluding a range of, other potential causes.
And that was Beth Cookson. She's Australia's chief vet, and she was speaking with Kath Sullivan. Now, farm safety advocates are urging farmers to report all incidents, including near misses on farms, after a horror start to the year in Queensland. Four people have died on farms in the Sunshine State in 3 months. Megan Hughes has this report.
It was on a ride around his own farm near Roma in southern Queensland when James Stinson came off his motorbike. He broke his ribs, suffered a lot of bruising, but it was the hit to his head that was the most serious.
The doctor told me my brain probably can't take too many more head knocks like that. So if I was a footy player, I'd probably be barred from the game after a HIA.
It took Mr. Stinson 3 months to recover from the accident, and in the 8 years following the crash, he's taken farm safety a lot more seriously. In total, 56 agricultural incidents have been reported to Workplace Health and Safety Queensland in 2024, and out of them, 24 involved a person being admitted to hospital. FarmSafe Australia Vice Chair Ruth Thompson says complacency, inexperience and fatigue are the biggest factors in accidents on farms.
During COVID, a bit of an uptick of farm incidences, and that was really down to the fact that we didn't have any workers. People who were living on the land and farmers were doing a lot more work to get the crop off, and they were doing that by themselves without any real workforce capacity. So we did see a little bit of an uptick of a few incidences over that COVID period, but that has since dropped back down as we've had more people coming back into the workforce on the farm.
Other than fatigue, what are some of the biggest issues that lead to incidents on farm?
People become quite complacent with what they do. When you've been doing a job for a very long time, complacency tends to be the number one risk that we have. You know, the old, I've done it a million times this way and I've been fine, but then unfortunately only takes one incident for somebody to get hurt. Sometimes it's a lack of experience. So we do get younger people coming into the workforce now on properties that are, you know, multi-generational removed from farms. They are very, very green. And they inherently don't understand some of the risks. It's very hard to download generational knowledge into new entrants into the workforce. So just trying to make sure that all of the people that are coming onto properties to work have that skill set that they do need to be safe on a property.
FarmSafe Australia offers free resources to primary producers on their website to help them implement better safety practices on their farms. Ms. Thompson says inductions and risk assessments are critical.
Farmers know what a risk assessment is. We live and breathe it inherently in our day-to-day lives where we go, oh, better not do that, that's a bit dangerous, or don't walk behind that horse, or we know that old cow's a bit cranky and she'll get you against the rails. So it's those things that we know, and just maybe having a bit of a formalised process for that as well. I'd say that 90% of farmers are definitely on that path already, but we still have a couple that are you know, might just be a smaller operation, and it might only be one or two of you on the place, and it might just be family, and you think that those things don't matter, but they are very, very important, and we just want to make sure that everyone can go home safe at the end of the day.
While serving as a councillor in local government, Mr Stinson chaired the council's safety committee and started implementing better procedures on his own farm. Then, following his crash and another incident while loading cattle, he ramped them up even further.
We try as much as we can now to wear helmets on all sorts of motorbikes. We limit the use of four-wheelers as much as we can, and we're conscious of where they go and what they do and the work that they do. The four-wheelers used here are all done at low speed and fairly level ground. We leave the creeks and the hills and the rocks to horses and motorbikes. We're continually reviewing the use of our motorbikes and horses for that matter. But then we made some changes to our existing loading ramp and installed a slide gate at the top of the loading ramp that can be immediately shut following the last beast going up the race, and at the same time we prefer that people didn't get in that loading ramp. And then we went on and actually built another set of yards and reviewed how we used our current yards with the findings and the thoughts following on from that. We worked with the contractor and continually reviewed our operations in the yards as they went and tried to restrict as much as we can the inclusion of people in with the cattle. And then the loading ramp was again with a slide gate at the top and a walkway and handrail.
Have you noticed any incidents or is it sort of an issue that seems to have resolved based off these procedures and equipment?
No, we haven't had any incidents or near misses either. And I guess, you know, this is just day-to-day stuff. And, you know, the vast majority of people do this sort of stuff. It's just being aware of what's around and maybe making some changes to alleviate that risk.
And that was Queensland farmer James Stimson ending that report from Megan Hughes. We've got a couple of texts. One from John saying Tasmanian apiarists should not fret about New Zealand claiming Manuka or tea tree honey as their exclusive trading name. First, we have leatherwood, and second, if I fail to see how Manuka's antibacterial effect in a test dish can be claimed inside a human stomach. John at Ferntree. Might not have read that quite right, but anyway. And also Jason, ease up, old mate beekeeper. You haven't had to water it or put fertiliser on it, and the price hasn't fallen as much as sheep and cattle. That's Jason. Of course, he's talking about the chat we had with Southern Beekeepers Association, Ross Gordon. Now, it's been pretty heavy going on the program so far, so I'm going to introduce a little light and shade. Let's go to a song with Angus and Julia Stone.
She's got this way wrapping her little heart around mine. Can I take you home? Can I take you home? We can go anywhere you wanna go. Can I take you high to the mountain sky? We can go as far as you wanna go.
A little light and shade on the Country Hour today with Angus and Julia Stone. Now, if you've ever bought one of those set-and-forget bug sprayers, there's a high chance it's full of an ingredient grown here in Tasmania. Pyrethrum flowers are not only pretty, they've paid off well this year for those growing them. Mark Raspin from Botanical Resources Australia says Tasmania has just had a record harvest and growers will get a 30% raise this year to try and attract more into the industry.
So we do some gross margins and so do the grower committee. So we're really looking at a figure just under $5,000 per hectare. If you look at the average yield based on the new payment that we're offering this year, it works out to be around $15,140 per hectare.
Right,
so based on the 2024 average yield.
So about triple what you pay, you can earn back.
Yeah, that's correct. There are a few things in our growing phase that have led to the increase in yields. And it's certainly becoming a more attractive proposition for growers to consider growing. Our plant breedings certainly led to increased assays, which has led to some improvements in yield, as has our increased harvesting capacity. And we also have refined our harvesting capacity recently with a bit of a change in how we go about our windrowing, trying to windrow all crops at the ultimate time frame to maximise the pyrethrum yield.
Mark, how do farmers see growing pyrethrum? I mean, 18 months is a bit of a long stint. Is that a turn-off to people?
Yeah, certainly for some people it is, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years when prices for all the commodities have been so high and interest rates have been high. Some growers have needed quicker returns than what we can provide. It probably does rule out some growers. We do pay prepayments to growers for growing the crop. So there's two prepayments there, which cover a lot of the inputs to really get the crop established in a way.
Right. Is that a proportion of what they might earn in the end?
Well, if growers have a successful establishment, we pay them $1,000 per hectare, and we also pay $500 the next June. Just a prepayment just to keep the cash flow ticking over those growers, and it's really covering the purchases of what they need in terms of chemicals and fungicides, herbicides, etc.
Are you looking for more hectares?
Yeah, very much so. We would like to increase our production level significantly in Tasmania, so we're very keen to get more growers on board, new growers, past growers, and also continue to work closely with our current grower partners. So the outlook for pyrethrum sales is very strong, and we need to increase our production levels to meet that demand.
Just in terms of your growers that you've got growing the stuff year on year, have people dropped off, or are you maintaining a consistent hectare base out there? What's happening with that?
Yeah, our existing grower database have been with us for a long time, and some very long-term supporters there up over 20 years. But a few years ago, we sadly did lose a few growers, and to get them back into considering to grow pie again, we've certainly had to put our payment rate up on the contract. So including this year for planting and last year, the payment increase has been nearly 30%. So we're hoping that'll really attract growers back into considering pyrethrum an attractive opportunity.
What happened those years ago?
I think we probably just fell a little bit behind some of the other growing options in terms of payment and some inconsistency in yield. So growers were probably concerned, but we seem to have sorted things out on the payment front, and also the last 3 years we've certainly had or got the consistency back in the performance of the pyrethrum plant.
And that was Mark Raspin from Botanical Resources Australia, which is offering a 30% increase this year for pyrethrum. Time now for the news headlines with Will Murray.
Good afternoon, Fiona. The monthly consumer price index has risen 3.4% in the 12 months to February. The Australian Bureau of Statistics says the most significant contributors were housing, food, non-alcoholic beverages, alcohol and tobacco, as well as insurance and financial services. Economists had expected inflation to rise slightly to 3.5%. China says it hopes Australia respects a recent World Trade Organization ruling and removes disputed tariffs. The trade dispute involves a Chinese complaint nearly 3 years ago over Australia's anti-dumping and anti-subsidy measures on products including railway wheels, wind towers and stainless steel sinks. A WTO panel earlier partially upheld China's anti-dumping complaint. And there are fears dogs may be more vulnerable to a bacterial disease because of a vaccine shortage. Thousands of dogs are on a wait list in Sydney, where leptospirosis is more common. The disease can cause liver failure and acute renal failure in dogs. More news at 1.
Thank you, Will. Time now to cross to the Weather Bureau and Michael Conway. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Now, can you tell me if there was any rainfall overnight?
Yeah, the highest rainfall in the inhabited spots was South Queensland was tops at 7 millimetres. Crater Valley, I mean, there's a few people there, isn't there, in a few of the lodges.
Yes, there are.
Veen got 5 millimetres, and there were scattered high falls in around the peaks in the west as well. Since 9 a.m, there hasn't been any significant rainfall at anywhere in particular except for the high peaks in the west.
Okay, now can you tell me what the outlook is for the next few days?
Yeah, it's going to be very settled over Easter with a high pressure system moving over Friday into Saturday. And we've got a ridge over us at the moment, so the high's off to our west. But over Friday and Saturday, it'll be overhead. And that'll mean very settled winds, so not very strong winds, not much cloud either. So fine days, warm weather, warming up into the weekend, into the mid-20s for most places on Saturday. And then as the high moves off to the east, it'll start get northeasterlies. There'll be a bit more cloud about. And on Sunday, we could get a bit of a southeasterly as well around Hobart, which might bring some drizzle to Easter Sunday, unfortunately, for the southeastern state, and lots of low cloud. But not much rainfall in it, just a little bit of drizzle. After that, though, things get back to more settled conditions. There's not much rain about for the next week.
Okay. Any warnings at all?
We've got zero warnings at the moment.
Right. Well, tell us about coastal waters and swell.
Yeah, sure. So the wind's about for today, west to southwesterlies at 15 to 25 knots, easing to south to southeasterly at 5 to 15, about the upper east and southern parts of the northeast during the day. The winds tomorrow, south to southwesterlies at 15 to 25 knots, but only variable winds 5 to 15 about the central west, central north and northeast. The swell's about. Today in the western south is a west to southwesterly at 2.5 to 3.5 metres. Tomorrow either slightly to more like 2 to 2.5 metres. And then in the north today, it's a westerly around 1 metre, and it's just 0.5 to 1 metre tomorrow. In the east, a southerly at 1 to 2 metres for both days, but offshore in the south, it could be a southwesterly at 3 to 4 metres. 2 to 3 metres.
All right. Michael Conway, thanks very much.
Cheers, Fiona. Bye.
Time for the family road trip.
98.
The big prawn.
Yes. Oh,
yes. Yes. 99. The big mosquito. It's a real one.
And 100.
Easy.
The big listen app.
Of course.
The ABC Listen app has a big array of road trip ready podcasts, radio, audiobooks, music and sport. Something for everyone.
I guess it has to be big to fit in all those podcasts.
Aww. For a big selection of audio entertainment.
Really, Dad?
Listen big. Download the free ABC Listen app today.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour. You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now here's one for Easter. A ton of cocoa now costs more than copper. Just in time for Easter, the price of chocolate has shot up and overtaken what was once the high-priced metal in the market. Cocoa is trading at $10,406 per tonne, while copper is trading at $8,743 per tonne. It's a remarkable turnaround from January 2022, when cocoa was just $2,000 and copper was $10,000. Now, Australia's largest cattle company is celebrating its 200th birthday this year. Australian Agricultural Company, better known as AACo, was started back in 1824. And from humble beginnings running sheep in New South Wales, the company now runs a cattle herd of around 430,000 head across 6.5 million hectares. CEO David Harris says the company has come a long way.
They started with a board meeting of a few people in London in about April back in 1824. Then was an Act of Parliament that actually established the company in about June, July of that year. Then in November of 1824, there was a royal charter signed. The first animals and people kind of didn't hit the shores of Australia till late kind of 25. They showed up on the shores with sort of 700 odd sheep, 15 odd cattle and 12 horses down near Stroud, actually. So just north of Sydney there on the coast, largely they were actually looking for sheep country. So that was an interesting spot, which didn't work out for them, but they kind of worked out that wasn't right and started moving north.
Now, cattle breeders in wetter regions saw strong results at the Te Manana Angus cattle sale on Friday, while cattle in drier parts struggled to find buyers. Angus joint CEO Tom Gubbins estimates around 25% of the 1,200 females up for online auction were passed in, predominantly in drier parts of Victoria. He says the cattle on offer were very similar between South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. So regional conditions explain most of the difference in valuation. And to the Angus breed again, it's been crowned Supreme Beef Breed Champion at the Sydney Royal Easter Show for 2024. The prestigious Hodden and Urquhart Awards were awarded to first-time winners Donna, Jack and Sam Robson from southern New South Wales. Donna Robson says it's a big win after a lifetime of showing at Sydney Royal.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Supreme Beef Breed Championship, the Horton Perpetual Trophy, goes to the Angus breed.
Donna Robson, and we're based at Adelong in southern New South Wales. I think with this cow and calf, it's just that she's a complete package. Like, she's a pretty impressive animal in her own right, and then she's got a pretty impressive calf beside her.
So is this a first for you, winning Supreme Exhibit?
Yes, it is, yeah. Yeah, yep.
That must be amazing.
It is, when you've been coming here for so long and just, yeah, turn up every year and keep competing, and, yeah, just shows that you just got to stick with it and, yeah, keep coming back.
Donna Robson from Southern New South Wales there. And a Southern Downs sheep producer has made a clean sweep at the Royal Easter Show in Sydney. Wendy Estranger from Rosenthal Heights near Warwick brought home the sash for Grand Champion Dorper Ram and Ewe and the most successful Dorper exhibitor overall. She says she's only been showing the breed for the past 12 months but has learnt what the judges are looking for.
I didn't know what to expect at all. I've only just, the last 12 months, been showing Dorpers.
And tell me, in these competitions, what are your sheep being judged on?
How much length they've got, their fat coverage, and if they're good producers for the meat industry. Yeah, and of course their conformation as well.
Is it a matter of getting them ready in the lead up to one particular event, or does it come down to habits that you've gotten into and things that you do to help their appearance pretty much from the moment they step onto your property?
Yeah, well, I've got to have them on grain for about 6 weeks before a show. Bring him in, look after him, just like anything else, preparing the animal for a royal show. There's a lot of work involved.
And what was the competition like? I mean, is the competition that much higher at the Royal Sydney Show compared to, say, the Royal Brisbane Show or the Royal Toowoomba Show or any other event that you might show at?
The standards at all royals are pretty good. I found at Sydney I went against different people, different studs, yeah, that I haven't competed against before.
What's the payoff for you for showing your sheep at these shows? Is it good for business, or is it just a challenge, or almost like a sport, a hobby for you? Where's the payoff for you?
We've got about 200 commercial Dorpers as well. We feed on grain and we take them to the sale yards to sell. With these stud rams we're putting over the commercial ones, we're getting better growth rates, better, they're growing a lot faster, just a better animal.
Right.
For the market, yeah.
And what's next for you? I mean, how much of your time, you know, in any given year is spent going around these shows, like the Sydney, the Royal Easter Show, and then up to the Ekka and some of the local competitions? How much is it spent showing your sheep at those, and how much is actually spent on the property, you know, going about your business as such?
I have a lot of time showing. I'm very lucky that way. My next show's in 3 weeks, Toowoomba Royal.
Are you?
And then I'm off to Dubbo again in May for the New South Wales State Sheep Show. And I'll have a couple of little local shows that I support in between.
And just finally, Wendy, is it very competitive amongst the owners who are showing? You know, can you sort of feel that tension? Is it very much, you know, the competition is very fierce, or is it a fairly friendly atmosphere?
When we're in the ring, it's very competitive, but at the end, we all get down and have a drink at the end of the day and talk about the day. And, yeah, we're all friends. But it's definitely competitive in the ring.
Right, yeah. Okay, gotcha.
More so at Sydney.
And that was Wendy Estranger speaking to David Iliffe about competing at the Royal Sydney Show. Now, the Australian Ginger Growers Association is urging people to consider spicing up their cooking by adding fresh local ginger, with sales impacted by the cost of living crisis from highs of $60 a kilogram in supermarkets during a global shortage in 2021. Ginger is now retailing for around $27 a kilo. Association President Chris Tadulu told Jennifer Nichols there's plenty of fresh ginger on offer.
Well, the season this year has been a good growing season without being an exceptional growing season. We've got a lot of good product out there in the Australian marketplace. We're pretty proud, being such a small industry, being able to supply all of Australia with our own Australian grown ginger and our own varieties. We're not relying on imported product for our fresh consumption, and a lot of our processing orders, like the Budgerin gingers, the Bundy brew drinks, the Gourmet Gardens, it's all Australian ginger, which we're very proud of. We support as an industry the processors. We've got an abundant supply of ginger available now, and And into the near future, we don't see that changing. You know, what we're looking for is consumers to probably pick up and support a bit more Australian ginger. You know, consumption is key to our industry being successful.
And how has that been tracking?
With the cost of living crisis that we're facing, ginger is not immune to that. Consumers are looking at what they spend and how they spend that money. So that's a challenge for everyone in produce at the moment. Is you'll see a news article after news article about the cost of living and how it is impacting on farming and the ability for us to be sustainable. So we encourage all Australian families to consume Australian ginger and Australian grown produce.
What's your favourite way of consuming it?
I'm big on the juice. I like the fresh lemon and ginger juice. My wife does a bit of baking, so the old ginger cookie works out well. So, but there's a multitude of ways we can use ginger, particularly having one of our most vibrant flavour profile gingers in the world with our varieties, with the oil contents, etc. We've got that extra zing in our ginger.
And for people who haven't heard much about what sorts of gingers we grow, can you give us a little bit of information about what you grow for the fresh market and what you might grow for processors?
Okay, traditionally for the fresh market, we're growing a variety called Canton or Jumbo. It's a variety that was brought into Australia about 70 years ago and has continued to reign supreme. It's a larger, less fibrous ginger. It's got a good, solid base flavour, but not an overpowering flavour. That's the Canton. Then we grow the Queensland variety, which is unique to us here in Australia. It has a very good kick to it. It's a really deep, very strong palated variety. It's not something you'll see at retail too often. It's mainly used by the processors like Bunyaroo Drinks, Gourmet Gardens and Budrum Ginger because they like that punch it packs.
What are the major challenges facing the industry at the moment?
Our major challenges is cost of production and sustainability. That's it in a nutshell. We're no different to every other Australian family out there. Our costs are going up and our income isn't matching it. So that's always a challenge for us. And ginger industry being such an expensive industry to get involved in, the setup costs and the need for labour is intense. We're looking at automation where we can, but we can't replace labour and the cost of that labour force and the cost of our goods is just increasing.
And what have growers been doing on that front to find workers?
Well, we're all doing our own part. Some people are on the Islander program, some back to working with backpackers because we've seen the backpackers' numbers start to increase. Always looking for a core members of staff in the regions, whether it be in the Sunshine Coast, Bundaberg or Northern New South Wales or even far north Queensland. Everyone's working towards getting a core group of people and we flush when we're in heavy harvest periods.
There's a lot of research going on to try to make the industry stronger and more resistant to pests and disease. What do you think is the most important work that's being done on that front?
The development of varieties, which may have some disease resistance, is extremely important work, but more so being able to access the required treatments to control. We can't control disease. What we can hope to do is suppress it. And that's the best we can. Ginger being such a unique crop and unique product to grow, it's very susceptible to different diseases.
The guava root knot nematode was found around the Hervey Bay region last year.
Yes.
Have there been any more outbreaks of that that you know of that are threatening the industry?
There's no other outbreaks that we're aware of, but Biosecurity Australia is monitoring it. We're keeping a close eye on it. All the association members are keeping an eye on their own farms to see that we don't have an introduction of it.
And for people who aren't familiar with the ginger industry, I mean, you've done amazing things to control Pythium, which is this terrible disease that then infects the soil, and you basically have to have two lots of clothes, two lots of machinery, and you can't move either of those from farm to farm. Yeah.
Full sterilisation, yes. Look, biosecurity, on-farm biosecurity is one of the biggest challenges the ginger industry faces. The only other industry I can think of that faces the same challenge is the banana industry, where you're actually sterilising vehicles, you're sterilising footwear, gloves. We don't work the same people in the same paddock on the same day. You work on one farm, you go home, you wash your clothes, you clean your boots, etc., then you show up to a different farm the next day because the cross-contamination is just 1 gram of soil can infect a farm.
Australian Ginger Growers Association President Andrew Christodoulou speaking there to Jennifer Nichols. Now, I'm sure you've heard of plenty of ewes having twins or triplets, but have you heard of an Aussie lamb having sextuplets? One crossbred merino ewe this week gave birth to 6 lambs. In the South Australia's southeast, hobby farmer Brad Shepherd says it was a very unexpected delivery.
Basically, walked out to go to work yesterday morning, and my partner came inside and said, oh, we've got lambs. We've been waiting. The lambs, the ewes are all about due. She comes in and said, yeah, we've got lambs. And I walked out, and obviously to my shock, walked out and saw six of them sprawled out across the ground. Unfortunately, one died at birth, but the other five are all doing quite well at the moment. So,
yeah, so you're fairly certain they definitely came from the one ewe?
Yeah, 100%. I went round straight away and checked the other ewes. Then none of them had sunken hips. They're all quite still, obviously quite full. And yeah, the mother, as you can imagine, was quite exhausted. She was laying on the ground for most of yesterday, but we've been tending to her and she's come back quite well now. We're currently putting the two lambs that we have left with us are back on her to give them the best chance. But the other three are with the lamb rescue at the moment. So we just sort of a little bit too much for us to take on all at once.
Have you ever had anything close to six lambs from one ewe before?
Oh, never, never. I'm, you know, not much of a farmer, a bit of a hobby farmer, as I said, but yeah, never. I have had sheep in the past and never had anything like this, and still quite shocked, to be honest. Yeah, it's not something you see every day, so it's quite special.
So, yeah, logistics-wise, is there anything special you need to do now with the lambs that are there? Will the ewe be fine taking care of those two?
Well, basically, we're just very, very lucky. We have people around our area, like Rebecca and Joe and whatnot, that do have the lamb rescue. So if it wasn't for the lamb rescue, it would have been a, you know, a lot of tending to the lambs and, you know, things like not getting colostrum and that on their first day is always a bad thing. So they've sorted those ones out, given them the colostrum and all the rest. And for us, it's basically trying to get the two that we've kept with us back onto the mother, as she obviously can't deal with six. Two's probably the limit. So, yeah, she's basically just trying to get her back with the lambs and see if she'll take them back on.
And, yeah, well, I guess what's the fate of the ewe now? Are you going to be breeding her again, seeing if she has another six in her?
Probably not. We're not here to breed, not here to try and make money or try and break any records or anything, just more so just for the kids to have a bit of that experience. I grew up on a bit of a farm and had that sort of upbringing and sort of thought it would be nice for our kids to have the same. And so, yeah, look, she'll probably, honestly, probably be retired and just go out into the paddock and live out her life, you know, with her hay and her feed and just enjoying it, I think. She needs a bit of a break after that.
Hobby farmer Brad Shepherd. So, just how rare is it for one ewe to birth six lambs? Well, according to veterinarian Dr. Amelia Reed with the Millicent and Kingston Vet Clinic, it's a very unusual occurrence.
To have six lambs is extremely rare. Normally, having triplets is quite common, but anything over that is an amazing feat, really, for that ewe. Incredible.
One in 100,000, one in a million. What kind of odds are we talking here, do you think?
Oh, we'd have to, I don't know off the top of my head, but we'd have to be talking over one in a thousand at least. However, I've never seen it actually occur in the area nor where I've previously worked before. So very, very rare.
I think the smallest lamb weighed in at 1.3 kilograms. Is that pretty small for a lamb?
No, that's not too bad. It is small, but that would be expected given the amount she's had and the ewes had to feed lots of those lambs in her belly for quite some time now. So that's actually quite a good weight considering the number that she gave birth to.
And would there be any long-term health impacts, would you think, for the ewe?
No, not really. Really, she's just going to need to have some good nutrition and a lot of love and a lot of care to pull her through raising the lambs that she has on her.
And the same goes for the surviving lambs? There won't be any long-term health impacts on the way they were born?
No, they shouldn't do, as long as they get lots of colostrum in that first 24 hours, which sounds like they have, and they have a nice steady plane of nutrition, they should be absolutely fine and go on to live a happy life.
Is there anything that leads to ewes having so many lambs, or is it just really luck of the draw?
Really, it's just luck of the draw. It's sometimes we just see this and, lucky girl and a surprise for the farmer, that's for sure.
Veterinarian Dr. Amelia Reed speaking with Elsie Adamo. Time for the Livestock Report now with Richard Bailey. Good afternoon, Richard.
G'day, Fiona. How are you going?
Very good, thank you. Just thinking about that ewe with six little babies. Phew, what a surprise.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen, a lot of us have seen plenty of triplets, but that yeah. sort of number is ridiculous. Yeah.
That's crazy. Now, yeah. Tell me how the market's been.
Yesterday at Perenna, we had a much bigger yarding of 183 trade and grown cattle. Really surprising for the week before Easter. Normally, there's not much around at all. I think it goes to show how dry it's getting, because a fair percentage of these were store cattle or store type cattle. There were very few good quality yearlings, and most of the unfinished types obviously were bought by restockers. Yearling steers made 200 to 254 cents, and heifers 170 to 200 cents. Some grown steers and bullocks, not many of them, they all made 210 cents, and heavy export heifers 190 to 218 cents. There was a pretty mixed yarding of 55 cows. The best heavy beef cows made 140 to 158 cents, which was a little bit cheaper than last week. Medium weights 110 to 118, and very lean, 40 cents to 96 cents a kilo, which went back to the paddock. The next highlight, well, obviously we're back at Parana next Tuesday, and then we're back there for a store cattle sale on the 4th, which is next Thursday, not tomorrow.
All right. Well, tell me about sheep and lamb.
It was almost a non-event over there, and there's a good reason for this. There's quite a big backlog at the moment of shipping across the strait, and remembering that a lot of our sheep and lambs are bought to be processed interstate. That word would have got around through the agents, who would have told producers probably to hold back a bit. There are only 299 lambs and 128 mutton, basically not enough to quote, but look, the better trade lambs made $90 to $110, light trade $40 to $100, and then restockers bought trade weight and trade and light trade weights from $93 to $110. Some of them had a bit of weight in them for, you know, they just picked them up because the processors didn't want them, and little lambs $25 to $30. As I said, there are only 128 mutton. The best made, $47 to $54. Restockers bought a light sheep from anywhere from $16 to $30 a head.
All right. Richard Bailey, thanks very much.
We'll talk tomorrow, eh?
We'll talk tomorrow. Wrap up, ready for Easter.
Yep.
And it's time now to speak to Joel Reinberger. Good afternoon, Joel.
Hello there, Fiona. What do you like to snack on when you're on the road, when you're taking a long trip?
Oh, it's pretty bad.
It usually is.
crisps, you know, chips, bag of chips,
okay,
bottle of mineral water.
What is your preferred flavour?
Honey and soy or
okay.
Chicken. My husband hates chicken, so if I'm by myself, I have chicken. But, yeah, I'm a bit of a gobble doc, which, you know, remember gobble docs? Love chips.
I know the gobble doc. I know the guy who does the voice for the gobble dog.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hello, Gibbo, if you're listening.
Oh, well, yeah, that's me.
Chippy, chippy, chippy.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah, look, I don't mind chips, but I'm more of a sweet person. So for me, it's
yes.
See,
I'm not. We've already worked this out when you talked about salads.
That's right. Yeah. So for me, it's chocolates and snakes. Snakes are always a winner.
Yep.
But, you know, lots of people go for a drive, you know, go to a shack, go to someone's house, go and visit relatives at the other end of the state over the Easter holidays. So we're going to talk about maybe some healthier snacking options for the car. I mean, that ruins the fun.
I'll have an apple instead of a bag of crisps.
But, you know, if you don't want kids zizzed up on sugar and, you know, you don't want yourself covered in chip crumbs.
That is bad.
You know, you get out and look at your lap and there's a perfect imprint of the chips you've been eating on your lap. And it's, you know, and then because they've sat there for a long time, they've just left grease spots on your pants.
Oh, yeah, that's annoying.
So we're going to start wearing aprons in the car.
That's a good
Fiona.
Idea. Yes.
or just a plastic bag. We'll just wear a garbage bag.
Yeah, because you sometimes don't get them all in your mouth when you're driving because you're concentrating.
So one of my favourites, though, is you go to one of the classic takeaway chains and you get some chicken nuggets. And then it becomes, if I'm driving, it's my wife's job to dip them in sauce and then feed them to me. That one doesn't have enough sauce.
Yeah, I used to like Macca's chips and barbecue sauce, but I don't do that anymore.
No.
Overstrained.
No. So we're going to talk about some of the healthy alternatives. And look, particularly with little kids, if you get them to do the cooking for you, they get really excited about snacks, even healthy snacks they'll get excited about. If they helped you make the hummus, then it becomes interesting to them. So we're going to talk a little bit about some healthier options for the car snacks today. We're also going to meet Dr. Vanessa Perotta, who is basically Australia's foremost whale expert.
Oh, yes.
She's got a book called The Humpback Highway, which is coming out about the mysteries of whales in Australia. But she's very well known because she invented a drone which could collect whale snot.
Right, in the water.
In the water. So I'm going to find out exactly what she learned from the snot of our whales on Afternoons Today.
Sounds very interesting, Joel Weinberger. And I'll catch up with everyone tomorrow at noon.
Start your day with Rick Goddard.
Join me for breakfast on Thursdays for the wide world of arts and tricky conversations where we look at the art of tough chats.
Breakfast with Rick Goddard, ABC Radio Hobart.